Hi, I'm Caroline, a yoga teacher with a special interest in menopause based in Edinburgh.
And hi, I'm Dr. Clara, GP with a special interest in menopause based in North London.
Together, we are the Menopause Sisters, and we are here to guide and support you through your menopause journey. Welcome to UK Health Radio, and you're listening to the Menopause Sisters, myself, Caroline, and my sister, Dr. Claire. And we're delighted this week to introduce Rebecca Wicks. And we met online, actually, didn't we, Rebecca? We came across each other through email, and I'd started a petition around trying to make Utrogestin prescribable here in NHS Lothian. So I'm in Edinburgh, many listeners do know I'm up in Edinburgh, and this is the micronized progesterone form of HRT. And you'd been in contact because you had also been looking into this and what was
Correct.
going on, and we ended up having a conversation via Zoom, didn't we, and connecting.
We did. Thanks both of you for inviting me on. It was quite organic, getting in touch, and I was doing some research. I just started doing some consultations under the umbrella of our pharmacy company for women who were really just wanting, I think, some time. I think, as we found out, has been key to be heard and to listen and to get some accurate information that perhaps the standard 10-minute GP consultation is it's ambitious to achieve everything. And in doing so, I'd had a couple of clients from Lothian, and I just wanted to do some fact checking really before, because as we know with medicine, well, with all things, everything changes at such a fast pace. And I was pretty sure that it wasn't on the formulary, and that kind of confirmed, but actually what came up first was your link, and the date was really recent, and I thought, oh my goodness, there's been something very kind of vocal about this. So that was really kind of a bit after the big menopause documentary that was on Channel 4 last year, that anybody that's vaguely menopausal got and watched. And yeah, reaching out to you really just to see how far you'd got with that. And I had been in the background doing some work with Utrogestin and the rep actually to try and see if we could make a kind of at the root cause of this a change. So it's kind of been looked at, but I don't know if there's any, there's certainly not a definite change with it being approved just now with for use routinely in Scotland. But individual health boards do make their own decisions, and Lothian have not, you know, kind of reviewed it independently in their own local area, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And actually, do you know, recently, very recently, it was actually just before Christmas, a woman had got in touch. She'd got hold of my email address, and she'd been in touch to say, wanted to connect for exactly the same reason. She couldn't get hold of it. And then just in the new year, she had got back in touch to say her GP practice had decided to start prescribing Utrogestin, which I thought was really interesting. So, there's kind of progress in that women are discussing it in this area. And hopefully, there's a little bit more discussion. I know the Menopause Clinic in Edinburgh, I've been looking into this and trying to make some noises around it as well. And we should probably explain, maybe Dr. Claire could go into a bit more detail, that actually it's a really safe form of progesterone to take, and the alternative would be a Mirena coil or a combined patch.
As Rebecca will know, and as Caroline, we've spoken about in the past, the evidence suggests that a micronized progesterone, so this is something that's chemically closely matched to what you would produce normally and naturally, and is derived from yams, is a very, very safe product, and actually probably one of the most breast-friendly progesterones that we have at the moment. The evidence suggests that it is the most breast-friendly, and really kind and to us. So less side effects. So it is really, it's a shame because I think there's a bit of a postcode lottery in many areas, not just in Scotland, but also in Wales, about Utrogestan. And I just wondered, Rebecca, if you could, for some of our listeners, explain what not on the formulary means. As a GP, I sort of get that, and I'm having constant arguments with medicine managements down in London. But I wondered what you, if you could just explain what that meant.
I'll do my very best. It's a while since I've been working in that arena. I did used to work in
the hospital side of things, at that kind of level, helping kind of review medicines to be included on the formula. That was a very long time ago. But yeah, basically, so I mean, the Scottish Medicines Consortium is a national Scottish body that look at the appropriateness of medicines on economic and effectiveness grounds. And when a medicine's new, they, even though it's been approved by the Medicines Health Regulatory Authority, the MHRA, they then review it again, if you like, just to put it in context with all the other medicines that are already available and say, right, because as we know, there's a certain pot, isn't there, of money to go around. And it's a shame, but it's a reality that we live within all areas of life. So what's happened in this case is that happened for this medicine in 2009, as far as I'm aware. And so it's simply not been reviewed since then. It was made by somebody else at that time, and the cost has gone down. So I guess this has probably fallen foul of a bit of a system situation through not being reviewed by the company that now make it. And so that's the conversation I've been trying to have with Bessins, because I think it's probably just been a lack of awareness. I don't think there's been any deliberate intention here. And I'm sure it'll be happening with other medicines for other conditions. So what's annoying and I think frustrating for this is that the evidence is really advantageous for a woman. And then when it comes to the formulary, Claire, that we've got health boards, and so they then have their own review again. So even though SMC, the Scottish Medicines Consortium, can say that something's okay, the individual health boards in Scotland can have their own formulary. And I imagine, I'm pretty certain that happens down south as well, actually, for the different kind of, you don't call them health boards though, do you? You've got a different name.
No, so we call them, well, they're sort of CCGs. So
that's right, yeah. There's still usually area, you know, formularies like Bristol and Swindon formulary. I consulted somebody recently. So they basically have their own experts, their own consultants with preferences. They submit it again to a board. It's a proper review. It's not just a wish list. And again, they make, so actually in Scotland, so interestingly, some health boards do have Utragestan on the formulary. And my observation, I don't know if this is accurate or not, my observation is that it's perhaps in places that have got a menopause clinic where the expertise of the medical staff is, you know, in menopause, and so they've been able to review it locally. But it's not across the board, as we know.
So I know that when I prescribe Utragestan here in London, you may be familiar with our software eMist. It's very specific in terms of, you know, you type in Utragestan and it's greyed out. That doesn't mean you can't prescribe it. It means that the software is telling you there's maybe a cheaper form that you could give. And I always just ignore that and just prescribe it.
Okay.
But I wondered if it's just in Scotland, is it just not available? Is it just something that you can't, it's not on the list of things that pop up when you try?
I couldn't comment for sure because I'm not a practice pharmacist and EMIS familiar, but I would imagine it is because some it's not on the formulary in Forth Valley, but my GPs are prescribing it. So for people where they think it's appropriate, and what's happening is the training, the recent confidence in menopause training is definitely picking up. So in some areas, even though it's not formulary, the resistance or the understand, I don't think it's deliberate resistance. You know, we've got very capable, highly qualified individuals who have done a degree in medicine and they're doing their best every single day. So I think it's just a case of understanding and realizing really. And I think with the selection on EMIS, there are processes for a non-formulary or non-SMC medicine to be prescribed. It just involves a bit of paperwork, and we have that in place as well. That maybe awareness of that is not that strong. It's called an individual patient treatment request, I think, an IPTR. Mm-hmm. So there are systems in place. But again, it's just about the realities of that. And yeah, it's a lot to kind of take on board in a 10-minute conversation as well, isn't it? So,
and I think that, like, you've hit the nail on the head actually there, because, you know, that we hear a lot of women who are just sort of tearing their hair out because they can't even get an appointment with their GP, or they don't feel heard. And I think I'd just like to do a big shout out for those GPs, because it's hard, isn't it? 10 minutes, like you say, to do this is really difficult. And I think that's another area of change we need to really focus on, because we're often told to do is, well, you can bring someone back and you can bring someone back 4 or 5 times. And I'm like, well, actually, if you can get that consultation done in half an hour and you give someone half an hour, you're much more likely to build up a good rapport, a robust history. You can get things done. And I think that's also where we need to change. We need to be kind of, that's obviously a bigger problem, but just giving women more
time. But it would be really lovely to have a half hour, just even just a one-off, you know, once you get to kind of, I don't know, kind of early 40s, maybe. We know that there's obviously kind of women that are menopausal prior to that, but just that opportunity so people know that it's there and it's available at some point, you know, to have a lengthier conversation.
And we do this commonly for diabetes reviews, for cardiovascular reviews, for over 75 health checks. You know, these people are getting 20, 25 minutes for an appointment, and they might have one with a nurse first that's 20 minutes and one with a doctor afterwards that's 20 minutes. So actually there is capacity to do that. So that's, I think that's something that Carol and I have spoken about before that is likely to make a really big difference. But anyway, I'm digressing as I usually do. On a tangent.
On that note, we'll pause there and listen to messages from our sponsors.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Dec, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
Once upon a time, human slavery was just a fact of life. Right now, animal abuse is often considered normal. In time, it won't be. Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living.
Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to UK Health Radio. You're listening to the Menopause Sisters Show, and today we're talking to Rebecca Wicks. And Rebecca, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the pharmacy you're part of. Obviously, it's a family business, and the work you're doing with your pharmacists and training them on the menopause.
Sure. So our pharmacy group is called Right Medicine Pharmacy after the Right Medicine document that came out from the Scottish Pharmacy Organisation back in, a long time ago, 2000 something, I think it was about then. So my husband and his really good friend bought their first pharmacy in 2000 at Stirling University. And they had great visions to, just to provide community pharmacy services. And all of their pharmacies really are in the heart of community. Sometimes they're the only kind of health service for a local population. So you won't perhaps, you won't find many of them really on high streets. There's a couple in Edinburgh that are maybe in busier areas, but the vast majority are really the kind of go-to for local communities who would otherwise need to perhaps get transport to getting care or to bigger services. So they've got 34 pharmacies now. So 20 years has seen a lot of hard work and effort and growth. And they are really, well, they've done really well through the pandemic. Struggling perhaps to get there's a couple of issues with staffing, which I'm sure everybody's getting across the country at the moment as COVID continues to need people to isolate and things. And really just I've worked in the company for many years. I've recently left to do an NHS post, and then once I decided to take this menopause work a bit further, I've just been wondering how I can successfully ask, you know, community pharmacists sensitive to their workload already, but to see how much we can contribute really to a woman's health journey. Bearing in mind that, you know, women are usually the gatekeepers of the family health, and they're the ones that go into the pharmacy, getting prescriptions, sorting things out, usually. So it just seemed just something worth exploring, and it's still in its infancy. I did a good webinar for the pharmacy managers, maybe about October or November last year, and it was really well received. A bit like MedX, Claire, there's no menopause education at undergraduate level. So everything I was saying, I think, was pretty new to what people were thinking. I qualified in 2000, and that was really at the point that the Women's Health study was coming to fruition. So I literally, I have to say, I really don't recall. I've always locumed, even though I was in hospital pharmacy to start with. And then once I was in community pharmacy, I really hardly remember giving out HRT. So that just gives a sense, really, of what's the situation. But the feedback from the guys was that it is on being dispensed a lot more. And what they felt now, especially after all the issues with shortages and things, that after the webinar, they just felt so much more confident in giving right advice, signposting, kind of gave some information about the BMS website, about the 14 fish training, the confidence of menopause training. And some of them have done that. And then even migraine cases and things, you know, I've had loads of feedback about how they've been able to help. And then if somebody's got a query, they just give me an email. And then some women have been referred on, and I've done a more in-depth consultation with them. So we're just kind of finding our feet on how, bearing in mind there's no funding for this as well. And we've got to be sensitive that, you know, there's at the moment, but there are wider plans. I've been part of a women's health plan meeting. We've just had three or four meetings with pharmacists across Scotland. And I think there is quite high hopes for developing some services for women's health. So, and some pilots are maybe going to start with that. So
sounds really exciting. And I guess from your point of view, I guess for as pharmacist, did you get very much teaching either at an undergraduate level for menopause or the perimenopause?
No, well, perimenopause, my goodness, I think even a year ago, I thought it was maybe the first I was getting my head around that term, actually, maybe just over a year. No, not at all. And actually, on that note, that had occurred to me as well. So whilst I was doing the webinars, I've just been kind of thinking of ideas and trying to see how far I go with them. So I got in touch with Strathclyde University. So they were really receptive, actually, and I'm doing a workshop for their final year students this year, just catching them before they go out. And then after that, we're going to sit and review and see if we can incorporate it into the curriculum. So that's really exciting, because that means that once you've kind of got that in there, the gap of, you know, qualified pharmacists is smaller, and then hopefully we can kind of just make sure that anybody coming out from undergrad now has some awareness at least.
Yeah, it's incredibly important. I think this is this kind of talking about it approach, and just as many people who know about this, or more people knowing about this, is going to be helpful, because actually, as you say, often women are the gatekeepers of family health, but also pharmacies can be the first point of call when there's something wrong. I'll just pop in and see the pharmacist, see if they can give me something for this or that, or and actually often you're doing that because we've talked about this before, but often a woman's going, oh, I don't need to bother the GP, it's not
yes.
So you go into
relationship. It's a very different relationship. I think I've always sensed that there's more, you'll get probably confided in a bit more readily in a community pharmacy. So, and you are doing that kind of supportive conversation. Sometimes you'll be prepping a patient to say, well, maybe try and say this, because it's this 10 minute kind of in out, you know, GP consult. So it would, you know, I think loads of them have found it so helpful, actually. And as we know, the empowerment conversation has been talked about quite a lot in menopause circles, hasn't it? Just so that women are really clear about what they're saying when they go in, and even just having faith that they can talk about it without hoping that the GP is going to diagnose or be able to say, oh, I wonder if it's this.
Yeah, absolutely. It's almost doing a little bit of homework and then guiding your GP and going, well, there's this, this and this. And so I think I've put this together, and then that guides the conversation with the GP, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, they've got that information now, and even resources like on the Balance app and things, or on websites such as the BMS, just with symptom checkers, they can, you know, provide that or signpost women to it. So, and then we're going to maybe do some audits as well. And we're ideally placed to maybe have a look and see if there's inappropriate antidepressant prescribing, which, as we know, can be a real first line option in the absence of having the latest menopause information. So and it's nice for them when they get the time to be able to do something a little different from the day job. So I was conscious over the Christmas period not to over pressurize them though, because it was obviously really busy. So but certainly lots in the pipeline going forward.
Wonderful. I read recently actually about a GP who's reviewing medication for depression within her surgery, actually, which I thought was quite fascinating. And just looking at the numbers and the statistics and reviewing that kind of 40 to 55 year old age group, which I thought was a wonderful thing to do. I mean, GPs are pretty much under the cosh that, you know, generally, but actually to find the time and actually review that and look at it and go, right, do we need to look a bit further, look a bit deeper?
Yeah, we're lucky up here that there's been a huge amount of funding. It's maybe not helped the staffing across the board, but we do have a lot of GP practice pharmacists now. So I've met one recently, actually, that's doing a great clinic over in Lanarkshire. And he's been doing exactly that. So just off his own bat, actually. So it's, you know, there is great work being done out there, but it's just about, you know, priorities and kind of, you know, having enough people to kind of get through everything. And of course, we are on a back foot after everything we've gone through with the pandemic from a health perspective. So
yeah, and I think that role of GP pharmacists is so interesting, isn't it? We have two pharmacists currently at our practice, and I'm in the process of trying to sort of enable them to do, potentially because they're prescribers, more of those initial consultations, more of the sort of, you know, symptom checkers, so that by the time they get to the GP, perhaps actually it's quite easy to do. But also it's like it's picking those people off that might have come in for some other reason, and just identifying that, like you say, perhaps this could be the perimenopause. And I'm really keen that it's not just GPs, that nurses and pharmacists do this too, because they've got such amazing skill sets. And like you say, often nurses have a different relationship with their patient, as do pharmacists.
Yeah.
Sometimes things are said that are not said to their GP, for example, particularly when we often find there's a lack of continuity in general practice. But where there is, it's great. But where there isn't, if you have the confidence within your practice to speak to the nurse or pharmacist, that can be really helpful too.
I agree, and we're more than skilled enough to do certainly the non-complex cases, do you know? So it's really, as most things, it kind of comes down to relationships, really. And it'd be really lovely to see even community pharmacists doing potentially that very initial screen and liaising directly with the practice pharmacist, for instance, and going into that, you know, care system there. And then from there, there's access to the GPs and perhaps referral pathways onwards for more complex patients that need a little bit more input. So there's lots of scope, and it is doable. So I guess it's just about, as with all things, kind of the time and funding and resource for things, isn't it?
That communication and that linking up of expertise, isn't it?
Yeah, sure.
I find that really interesting. I'm just going to digress for a second, because for years we have been chatting about virtual consultations and telephone triage and how can we move things more virtually and include, you know, younger people definitely don't want to come into the surgery and have a face-to-face consultation. I mean, I'm not joking. It's been years in the making. And then suddenly overnight, we did it. Suddenly overnight, we went to total triage, virtual consultations.
When a gun was to our heads, it just happened, yeah.
Interesting, it can happen. It just, you need the means for it to happen. So I think it's possible. I think actually it's really achievable. This is, we've moved so far forward and so far on from that WHI study that there isn't really an excuse anymore, is there, apart from pressures, but yeah.
And I think there's also always going to be women who would prefer a one-to-one consultation face-to-face, and, you know, have that discussion. But actually, for many women, it's convenient, you know, if they're juggling family or jobs or elderly parents, whatever's going on in their lives. And actually, it's not to underestimate a phone call with your doctor or nurse or pharmacist, and not to underestimate, you know, a video call, because actually, it's incredibly helpful. It's from my point of view, I know I've had a couple of phone calls with my GP and it's been exactly the same. It's not been any different, you know. So it's kind of allaying those fears that it's not quite as good as. I think it's incredibly helpful. We'll take another pause there and listen to some messages from our sponsors.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living. We've been doing this for over 40 years. Every year, more and more people are living satisfying lives completely cruelty-free. Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to the Menopause Sisters Show. I'm here with my sister, Dr. Claire, and we are talking to Rebecca Wicks today, a pharmacist based in Scotland. And we've been talking really just about the role of community pharmacies and Rebecca's family business and how they can play a really important role in supporting women in diagnosis and perhaps discussing the options around HRT and other options as well, and can be the first point of call for many women. And we wanted to move on to some recent media coverage that we've come across. And for those not in the UK, there's been media coverage around testosterone. And it wasn't, I guess, researched well, the coverage that we'd seen. And there's been a little bit of a backlash. And Claire, maybe you could start us off with just the facts about testosterone, actually.
Yeah, so I think recently there's, as is often the case, there's been some myths that we've needed to debunk a bit, not only about sort of traditional estrogen and progesterone therapies, but also testosterone. And we know that testosterone is licensed, certainly in the UK, for symptoms of hyperactive sexual desire disorder, bit of a mouthful, HSDD. And it's meant to be used as an adjunct to traditional HRT if a woman is still feeling that her libido is quite low. That is the license for it, which always makes me a little bit angry, because we're more than just our libido. And we know that libido in women is very complex. It's not just related to hormones. It's related to lots of things. But testosterone can be really helpful for a number of menopausal symptoms. So it can be helpful for things like brain fog, memory disturbance, yes, libido, but joint pains, confusion, anxiety, low mood. So it often is very, very helpful in women who have been adequately estrogenized. By that, I mean women who have had a good dose of estrogen for a long time, but are still not feeling great. Now, it won't work for every woman, but in a similar way, HRT won't work for every woman. You know, we're all individuals. But it is certainly an option. And I think some of the press coverage recently has really focused on it not being an option, or it being of limited use for certain specific symptoms, such as libido, which we know is not the case. So there's quite a significant battle going on to try and get testosterone more licensed in certain parts of the country, and to get more female body identical forms licensed, because we know it can be really, really helpful. And we know that actually as women, we probably produce 3 to 4 times the amount of testosterone from our ovaries as we do estrogen. And we produce significant amounts from our adrenal glands too. So actually, if you take away your ovarian production, your levels fall quite significantly. And if you've had your ovaries removed because of a medical procedure, women often feel that women often feel the effects of not only estrogen loss, but testosterone loss even greater. And so it's a really important conversation to be having with women if that's the case, because it can really change things.
I would like to ask, actually, why we start with the estrogen and progesterone if needed, obviously, rather than go straight to testosterone? Because I know that's a question that often comes up and women are just unsure and unclear about that.
Yeah, so I think if you look at some of the guidelines, it suggests using testosterone after HRT. And when I say HRT, I mean whether it's estrogen alone or estrogen and progesterone. And the reasons behind that is essentially because if you don't give estrogen first, then a lot of the testosterone, and this is a very simplistic view, a lot of the testosterone will be what we call aromatized to estrogen in the body. So testosterone gets converted to estrogen in the body. So the thinking is, get your estrogen levels high enough so perhaps your body doesn't need to convert quite so much of it to estrogen. And so you've got more free testosterone floating around in the blood to do what it needs to do. That's a very simplistic way of looking at it. But essentially, that's the case. Now, there's many occasions where we may actually give all three together if we feel that it's appropriate. But my biggest bugbear is the limits of what we can prescribe, because as you know, Carolyn, and probably Rebecca, you know this as well, we don't have a body identical form in the UK. We have two or three that are licensed for men and are used off license for women. So they're not traditionally meant for women, but we can use them in smaller doses for women. And so we're trying to as much as possible use tiny doses to get the desired effect, if you like. But I don't know what it's like in Scotland. Is it something that the menopause clinics can often prescribe, or do you see that very much, Rebecca, Carolyn?
We are able to get it. I think maybe if you've had a hysterectomy, it's more almost accepted as part of the treatment. I think if you haven't, then I think it's possibly clinic initiated. And then, of course, not every health board has got a menopause clinic. So we've got the same criteria as you for the preparations with the licensing and non-licensing. So as far as I know, the vast majority of the women that have it do get it privately, even if they've maybe been able to get their estrogen and progesterone on the NHS. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit of a mixed bag. That said, I have done a consultation this week whereby a nurse who was doing this patient's HRT consultation in the practice did offer it. I don't know. Of course, there's been a huge rapid uptake in the training. So I don't know whether things are changing, but I think there'll always be that kind of tape around the fact that there's this, you know, what's allowed and what's not allowed, again, a bit like the Utrogestan. So I think it is mixed and not as readily accessible, I would say. Also, lack of confidence. Yeah. Of prescribing, and you can kind of understand that. That said, the guidelines, nice guidelines, do kind of really break it down. The BMS website has good information. Balance website has good information. There's quite a lot out there, but you can kind of understand if you've not really done it before. It is quite perhaps something that's going to take a bit of time to become the norm, maybe.
And I think for a lot of women, they're just unaware as well that testosterone's even a female hormone.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Still a lot of, my goodness, I've certainly got, there's many women who don't even realise about menopausal and menopausal, and that's just not something that's going to happen for them. We've got a spectrum out there for sure. So, and testosterone is always a bit, there's huge stigma with that, isn't there, as well, about, you know, kind of what that means and what it does. So it's still probably a lot of education to do with that, I would say, to help women kind of slowly adjust to it being perhaps in the cases where estrogen, progesterone is being used, but just not quite enough. And I see that quite a lot. It's often why people are coming to see me, actually. It's because we do have everything maybe based on HRT being the golden ticket, and it's a bit of a kitchen sink phase of life, isn't it? You need to throw everything at it. So
Yeah, we were talking about that recently, weren't we, Claire, actually? Because actually it's not the magic bullet always. It takes a little bit of tweaking, and perhaps even once it's tweaked, you know, that's going to have to be changed every so often, because symptoms can change and those levels can change. And so it's not a kind of one size fits all. Once you've got it, that's you sorted. And there are other things, you know, we often talk about, you know, diet, lifestyle, movement that can help as well, and looking at other things. But actually, I was having a conversation with a friend this week I'd met up with, and feeling a bit nervous about starting her combined patch. And, you know, she's got it. She had to really fight for it. she's in her early 50s. You know, and I think a GP had said something along the lines of, why do you want this now, kind of thing. You know, you're almost through it. And so she's fought for it, and now she's not sure. She's feeling a bit nervous about it. She said, but I think actually I just need testosterone because actually my libido is just not there. And I said, well, you've got to estrogenize before, you know, the testosterone. So, but, you know, even just that knowledge, and she'd done a lot of homework, she'd done a lot of reading, so she was able to go to her GP and get what she wanted, but she's now feeling a bit nervous. But having that knowledge, I think, you know, and us having this discussion, all we can do is try and help and support and inform, can't we?
And support women too. I met a mum on the side of a sports field last weekend, and we were honestly watching our respective children playing sport at the same time as having a conversation about menopause. So, because her son was playing rugby, my daughter was playing hockey, so we were kind of had our heads turned like in different directions. Multitasking, I tell you.
So
she was saying about being your own advocate, really.
Yeah, and actually, these are the conversations on, you know, again, a rugby pitch just before Christmas. I was talking to two women. You know, I guess I'm starting to get a bit of a reputation around menopause. But Caroline, this, you know, and it's great because actually that's possibly the times these conversations happen with friends on the football pitch, on the rugby pitch, on the hockey pitch, wherever you are, with other mums, with other women. Perhaps sometimes in the workplace when you see a colleague, you know, just going a little bit red and having that hot flush, and having these conversations, and whatever you do know, or helping to signpost other women to, you know, research evidence-based guidelines and websites, and just say, well, have a look at that, you know, and do a little bit of reading, because it takes a little bit of time to absorb it all and work out
where
you are, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I find that even with my health professional background, I don't know what Claire's journey into it being, because I'm pretty sure medical-wise it wasn't in the undergrad curriculum either, but yes, it definitely took me reread, and that was probably to reverse all the perception of the stigma that we'd really just come out from uni, it was all going off, and it was like, and actually it was interesting, it was because I've got quite, my friend group tends, averages maybe 5-6 years older than me, and they had come to me, and I kind of said, oh, I'm not so sure. I said, but let me look into it, because I always do that. And I knew that I'd maybe just been out of, maybe was doing some education and training role at the time. So I wasn't kind of perhaps up to speed with frontline practice. I said, let me look into it and get back to you. And it was really at that point that I started to realise that actually, and so bearing in mind that's my background, and, you know, medicine and care is day in, day out. You can understand how it's really quite a lot for women to take on board, you know.
Yeah, especially when that lack of confidence and brain fog is in the mix as well.
Sure. And I was nervous at my first GP appointment, really nervous. And my history of migraine has, you know, it was a real light bulb moment for me, and a huge relief to think that that's why they were getting so debilitating and so bad. Mm-hmm. But actually my first appointment was, well, let's send you back to neurology, and why don't you try this anti-epileptic? And I kind of just, my gut instinct was, no, that's not really what I need to do now. But we've come full circle a year on. My GP's done the training, and, you know, we're both really quite, you know, on the same page with things, which is lovely. But yeah, it is a challenge that we all need to kind of try and understand each other as best as possible.
And something else that's been reported in the media very recently as well is, you know, many women leaving work and because of symptoms. And actually, we'd been contacted by a woman who, I think she's 73 last week, and she'd just been seeing a little bit more around menopause. She'd been reading a bit more around menopause. I think it's just, you know, a little bit more in the media over the last sort of 2-3 years. And she just put two and two together. She'd left her job, you know, I think around 20 years ago, and she can now see that it was due to menopausal symptoms. And my heart sank for her, but at the same time thought, well, I know she won't be alone in of that generation, but in our discussions today and what we're doing individually and together, being able to help support and educate and just share this information. So actually, whilst I feel like we're the generation maybe fighting a little bit more for it and shouting a bit louder about it, the next generations to come won't have to do this.
Yeah, hopefully not. I definitely, from personal experience, I've had two career breaks, and the first time I just really didn't know what was going on, and I just thought it was accumulation of kind of burnout and various things. You kind of just think that you really are kind of going crazy, I guess. I had no energy. I just felt like I'd hit a brick wall. And I was fortunate that I was in a position where I could stop work for a while. I actually went to therapy, which I don't regret, and that was really useful. And I still think part of our process, and we are kind of, we're a bit of a diagnose, treat, cure kind of society. And I do think there's a bit more about understanding and a value to wider kind of therapies other than just HRT or whatever it is for your individual situation, condition. And I felt benefit from that, and I eventually went back to work in the NHS. But by that point, then the migraines were really kicking in, and I couldn't understand, why everything was just becoming so difficult again. And I was on HR monitoring, which is so shameful in itself, because you just think you're trying your best, you're wanting to turn up, and there's not really that much that anybody could really do. So it's been a real kind of roller coaster, and you have to hold on really tight to. And I only feel I've got to where I'm at through my own inquiry about everything. I would just say to people kind of having faith, but there's still quite a lot of people that don't, can be quite lonely. I certainly found that experience quite lonely. And I'm only 44. So that was actually, I think it was maybe about 38 or 39 when that was starting. And I didn't have any of the conventional night sweats or hot flushes. So it's, I think that it was perimenopause starting then. It's retrospective for many people it is. But I think if we're more informed going forward that, kind of our children and their children will hopefully just be mainstream care.
Yeah, and we know that 1 in 100 women go through menopause under the age of 40. So it's not quite as uncommon as we maybe think. It's still, again, that stigma, oh, that's ages away, 50, 60, 70. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So just having that awareness. And Claire, you were saying, you often see people in clinic that have left jobs or are thinking about leaving their jobs.
Yeah, so we were saying before we started, I saw three women on Monday, all of whom had left their workplace. That was one after another, and that was obviously in a menopause clinic. That's just to put that into context, that wasn't just GP land, but it was in a specific menopause clinic. And it's just really sad, because if we start to lose these women from the workforce, then where's that dynamic, where's that gender equality? And women have such a powerful role in life and in the workplace, and to lose your confidence like that when you think it could be perimenopause or menopause is actually really quite sad. And I know there's a lot of work going on around this and trying to get more menopause awareness within the workplace and for employers. And I think that's brilliant. I think, we just need to be having this conversation so it's not a taboo. And so women can go, oh, actually, maybe that is me. Maybe that's why I can't go into that meeting, or I'm having palpitations because I'm feeling so anxious. Maybe that's me, and have those open conversations, even with friends. If that's where it starts, then brilliant, and then take it further.
We've covered everything we wanted to cover. I just want to say a huge thanks, Rebecca. Thank you so much for joining us today and having that discussion, because I think it's really interesting to work out what's going on in Scotland, and obviously Dr. Clare's in London, so under the England NHS board, and just have that kind of discussion of differences and what we're all doing in these different areas supporting women and how we're doing it. And great to hear about the work with the pharmacists you're training up as well, and that kind of education so women can find the information they need at various points.
Thanks, guys. It's been great to come on and speak to you both, and you're both doing great work as well, and it has been really lovely just to get a connection across the board. And I actually felt any work I've done, it's all been really largely quite well received. So we're obviously all trying to kind of swim from the same shore in getting everybody the help that they need. So really appreciate being invited. Thank you.